Tonight, our special guest on Coast to Coast AM, Robert Bavall. We're going to be talking about his work, Black Genesis, The Giza Gate, The Orion Mystery, all of Robert's phenomenal works, and we're going to talk about Egypt as well. Later on, Ahmad Osman joins us. We'll be talking about Zahi Hawass as well, and the latest on that situation, of course, on Coast to Coast AM. So stand by. Robert Bavall joins us in just a moment on Coast to Coast AM. And, of course, Robert Bavall, author, lecturer, ancient Egypt researcher, best known for his Orion correlation theory. Robert, born in Alexandria, Egypt, and in 1889, he published a study which proposed that the layout of the three Giza pyramids and their relative position to the Nile was intended to mirror the layout of the three stars in Orion's belt and their relative position in the Milky Way. Robert has spent most of his engineering career living, working in the Middle East and Africa as a construction engineer. Here's Robert Bavall on Coast to Coast. Robert, always a pleasure to have you on. How are you?
How are you? It's always a pleasure to be on your show, George.
Tell me a little bit about what the heck happened in Egypt with Mubarak and everything else.
That's one hell of an opening question, George.
It sure is. I start right from the right away.
Right from the top, huh? Okay, well, first let me set up the context here. I'm sitting in on a couch in the south of Spain. It's 8:10 a.m.
Okay.
And I was in Egypt, in fact, a few weeks ago, and I'm returning there on Friday. So that's the context of which I'm talking to you from. Well, what happened to Egypt? Let me start with this. I was there in October with a tour that I was escorting in around Egypt. And Egypt, that's a few months before the revolution. And then, bang, everything... The impossible happened when I left. So I'm not responsible for the revolution, George.
No, not at all.
But I'm saying this because I returned after the revolution. In fact, I was there at the end of March. And it seemed as if I was returning to a different country. It's extremely hard to explain. I said this on a previous show, and I'll say it again. It was a bit like traveling on a time machine and going back to the French Revolution a few days after the taking of the Bastille, or a few days after the signing of the Declaration of Independence in the States. It really felt that way. You know, I was returning to a country that had metamorphosed itself almost overnight. It's not so visible to the eye. My first impression when I returned was that, you know, here I was again in Cairo with the usual traffic and the noise and the street vendors and the taxis and the crowds in the street. At first, I was a little bit disappointed. I thought, where is this revolution?
Yeah.
But then... It shows in the people. There is something amazing. It's a bit like the whole nation was given a happy pill, you know, and they it shows in their face, it shows in their posture, it shows in the way they talk, of course. It's quite extraordinary. Something happened, a sort of critical mass to the population. And it's amazing. I mean, the first thing you hear, I happen to be picked up by some young, two young people at the airport who were sent by the office, and they had taken part in the Tahrir event, and they're beaming. I mean, their eyes are glowing when they talk to you. It's as if they've received a huge Christmas present.
Yeah, yeah.
And they, the first thing they tell you is that we're not afraid anymore, and it's very hard for us Westerners to understand this. I do, because I've lived in Egypt for a large part of my life. I was born there, as you rightly said, And I lived through the very difficult parts of Egypt's modern era, from the first revolution in 1952 to I left Egypt when I was nearly 20 in 1967. So I know exactly what they mean, because under such an oppressive regime for such a long time, people began to be totally closed, afraid to speak, afraid to vent their opinions, under this kind of dark cloud all the time. So suddenly, there's a kind of release, an amazing release that is witnessed with the people. And Egyptians are naturally very talkative people, but now they really, really talk. It's the first thing you notice. They can't wait to tell you, especially foreigners when they arrive, about what happened and how they feel and how they're looking forward to freedom and democracy and how they're not afraid of the police and so forth. So that's the first impression you get. You're going to stop me somewhere, George, because...
No, I'm fascinated. I'll jump in whenever I have to, Robert.
Yeah, please, because you know me. I can go on for hours like this.
As you know, my father was born in Cairo, so that region of the world is very special to us. And, he ended up coming to Detroit after he was 6 years old. All his life, he kept telling me about things in Egypt that he could remember as a little boy, pictures of him sitting on a camel, pictures of him by the pyramids. And the fact that you've been there way more than he has is just really fascinating to me, Robert.
Yes, I know of your background, George. We talked several times about this, and I'm sure that your father, even though came at an early age, always remembered his roots in this country. You know, the whole civilization has its roots in Egypt. I mean, that's the thing about Egypt. And I was asked a few weeks ago on an interview, you know, when is the last time Egypt had a democracy? And I said, never.
Never.
it's never known what we know and take for granted in the Western world. I mean, since the beginning of its history, it has been under autocratic rule. For 3,000 years, the pharaohs ruled Egypt. And although they had a very high spiritual approach to their lives, nonetheless, the pharaohs were supreme, believed to be gods on earth, and they ruled as such. There was no democracy. Then came, of course, the various occupiers. There was first the Persians, then the Greeks, who ruled Egypt for 300 years. Then came the Romans, who ruled with an iron fist for nearly 700 years, and then came the colonial occupiers. And then finally, in 1952, they had the so-called Free Officers' Revolution, and everybody thought, wow, the monarchy has been toppled and freedom at last, but it didn't happen. What they got was a military junta that lasted for 60 years, and Mubarak is part of that phase. So really, they haven't known any form of democracy at all. So all this is relatively new and very exciting for them. You know, it's especially for the young people. I mean, it's to me, I was astounded. I mean, let me give you my impressions of what happened in Tahrir Square, as we all watched on TV for 18 days. I mean, quite an extraordinary situation of watching that live, a revolution taking place live on an hourly basis. I mean, I always compare it to other revolutions of the world. It's a bit like having a time machine and flying to France in 1789 and actually witnessing these history making events. So, but to me, what was astounding, and I think to the rest of the world, was the amazing courage of young people. I mean, the word courage suddenly came huge in my mind. I mean, their persistence, their tenacity. You know, they were gassed, they were shot at, they were beaten, they were attacked by camels and horses.
Jeez.
And they stayed. You know, they stayed there with their flags waving and refusing to budge before they got what they want.
Well, for that region of the world, even going back into the days of antiquity, Robert, these people were so advanced. They had so much culture, whether it was their libraries or how the pyramids were constructed and why they were constructed, yet they were always taken over by someone. Isn't that amazing?
Well, true. But like I said, the first phase, which is a rather long phase, the pharaonic phase, lasted for 3,000 years, and it was an Egyptian phase. It's very strange to think that although Egypt was ruled for 3,000 years by pharaohs, it's estimated that there were 420, I think, pharaohs that ruled Egypt over 3,000 years, all extremely powerful, believing that there were gods on earth. The population in general, including the aristocracy and the ruling families, were extremely spiritual. This is something very difficult to understand for modern man or other modern cultures, but they were extremely spiritual, and they had what they called a divine order. Everything was orderly. They believed in that they had been created or given the civilization by the gods, and the gods had handed them with a order. They called it this mat, the order of mat, a cosmic order. It's very interesting because this system of order was not only adhered to the letter, but was very much entrenched in the psychology of the people. They all followed this order religiously and socially, and everything was fine. For 3,000 years, they had no problems at all. Everybody respected everybody. Everybody respected nature. Everything was sacred. So this is the wonderful model that we have of ancient Egypt. And then things went bananas.
Yeah, they did. They did in a big way. Let me ask you about this, Robert, for just a moment. Zahi Hawass, the story yesterday was that he was going to jail. They convicted him. They're going to send him away for a year. Now he's put on his blog that he's still going to stay in head of antiquities. He's not going to go to jail, and everything's fine. What's going on with him?
I think I need to say something beforehand before we talk about or try to understand the situation with Zahi. You know, politicians in general, but particularly people like Zahi Hawass, have become accustomed so much to their own spin that they actually believe it. It's a strange thing. It's a strange phenomena that, you know, I've known Zahi for the last 30 years or so, and in the days before the revolution, when he was part of the Ministry of Culture, and this particular ministry controlled the media in Egypt completely, it was amazing that certain things were said that were obviously misleading, obviously not true. And yet, there they were in print, you know, and the strange thing is that the people who actually said these things, you know, the Minister of Culture and other people in the cabinet, actually believed them. You know, there is a famous phrase from the Marx Brothers. You remember the Marx Brothers, George?
Oh, I do.
Well, Groucho Marx is...
I was a kid, but I do remember them.
Well, I was a young man in those days. But anyway, Groucho Marx is particularly well known for his famous sayings. And on one of them, very much comes to mind every time I speak about Zahi and people who spin their statements. Groucho Marx once said to an audience, "Do you believe what I say or what you see with your own eyes?" And this is one of those strange things with Zahi. I mean, sometimes it's baffling that... I'll give you this example of yesterday that you yourself mentioned, that he put on his blog that he has made an appeal, and the appeal has been accepted, and he's now going to stay, and so forth. He's actually put the image of a document in Arabic on his blog, which is supposedly this acceptance and decree. He called it a decree, a special decree that was issued. This document is none other than a receipt of his appeal. Let me explain how the system works. When a court, in this case a criminal court, issues a sentence, the person receiving the sentence has 10 days to appeal. In those 10 days, he or his lawyers deposits a request for an appeal. When this request is deposited, they receive a document saying, "Thank you very much, we've registered your appeal." That's the document. It's not a decree. It's not a removal of his sentence. It's just a receipt. But there you are. I mean,
he might not have been vindicated then at all, right?
No. The appeal will be heard. If I understand from contacts I have in Egypt, the appeal will be heard on the 6th of June.
Ah. Okay.
So there's a bit of time for that. Now, the system, again, if I understand it well, is that basically he is appealing against the sentence, and therefore the court, having accepted the appeal, they normally do, will again review the case with the documents that were originally placed. He cannot bring in new evidence, for example, or come up with new arguments and so forth.
And those, by the way, are just tuning in. We're talking about Zahi Hawass with Robert Bavall. Zahi heads up Egypt's Antiquities, and he's the one that you see running around with the hat on near the pyramids, wherever they do new excavations, and he's very excitable. He loves what he does. We'll get into a little bit about that, Robert, as well. But that's who we're talking about now. Go ahead, Robert.
Yes, for your listeners, maybe we should explain who Zahi is.
He's tough.
He's a tough guy. He's a tough guy. He's got nine lives, as people say, you know.
I remember once I asked him about the possibility of extraterrestrials in the pyramids, because it's a great theory, right? And he went crazy. He went nuts. I don't want to talk about that ever again.
Yeah, I'm sure that many of your listeners have seen this this series on History Channel called Chasing Mummies. Have you seen it, George?
Yes, sure have.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's extraordinary that it was, I mean, he even approved to have himself portrayed in this way. I mean, I was astounded. I mean, you know, I know Zahi. I know his style. And I think I should say this, you know. There is two sides of Zahi. You know, there is a charming, very generous side. Mm-hmm. He can be extremely friendly. He actually adores his job. There's no doubt about it. He's very enthusiastic about his job. And you know, whatever one says about him, he's a genuine Egyptian. I mean, he really
We're going to take this break, Robert, then we're going to come back and talk about the other side of Zahi Hawass as well, and then we'll also get into your work in the Black Genesis and the pyramids. I'm George Norrie. Robert Bavall, our special guest, will be back. And our special guest tonight, Robert Bavall. We're talking, of course, about Egypt. We'll get into the pyramids and some of his latest work as well. That'll be next on Coast to Coast AM. We're with Robert Bavall. Robert, so on one hand, Zahi Hawass is very outgoing, promotable, loves his job. But then there's that other dark side of him, isn't there?
I don't know if it's a dark side. It all came out in Chasing Mummies. I mean, the man can become extremely hysterical and angry and
agitated,
shouting at people, really losing it completely. And you know, it makes you wonder what is the real Zahi. I've actually seen him and met with him many, many times, and I've had some very, very strange experiences with him. I mean, I recall once being in his office, and, you know, I don't work for him. I don't work for anybody, as a matter of fact. I have the pleasure of being an independent author and for many years, but he treated me as if I was his coffee boy. It was quite incredible. So I literally had to stand up and say, Zahi, please read my lips. I do not work for you.
Good.
You know? And he just looked at me completely baffled, turned green and red. And, you know, he is so used to this autocratic, powerful position that he has. I mean, I need to explain this because...
And he's not used to someone standing up to him like you did.
Well, that's it. I mean, nobody does. I mean, I think I'm among the very few who have stood up to him and survived. Because, but I need to explain something. You know, when you are in a position as he is, and he's not the only one. I mean, people who have gained position of power in Egypt or in these countries where which were ruled by force, by an iron fist, have become so used to their own position of power that it is frightening to see sometimes. I mean, Zahi, prior to revolution, because things have changed now, but, you know, with a flick of a finger could send somebody to jail. You know, people were terrorized working for individuals like that. And not just the people working for him. I mean, you know, the population in general. You know, ministers were extremely all-powerful. And there was, of course, the whole machinery of the state security that, and of course, the so-called emergency laws that permitted the government and therefore people in position of power to have anybody arrested anytime without a trial, you know. So with that kind of mood, you know, people were extremely scared, and sadly, those in power took advantage of this.
I've always thought, Robert, that Zahi might have in his house some of the greatest Egyptian relics that aren't in museums, but he kept them for himself. I don't have any proof at all, but he just seems to be that kind of guy. You know, I even think, if you believe in Edgar Cayce saying that the Hall of Records was at the base of the Sphinx, part of me thinks that Zahi dug it up and he has it in his house. I don't know why I think that way.
Well, we'll get to that a bit later in the discussion, but there's all sorts of rumors going on, particularly about Zahi and the antiquities. And, you know, at the moment, I mean, especially in these very confusing times, there is rumors about everything.
Yeah.
You know, so it's hard to make out what is true and what is not true. However, I must say that, you know, I've always been a bit baffled by Zahi Hawass. I mean, you know, yes, it's true. I've Well, I lived in Egypt for a long, long time, so I can perhaps have a kind of third eye to see what's behind these events and try and sift out the rumors from the truth. But there has been a lot of funny things going on at Giza. A lot of them are rumors. A lot of them are quite wrong.
And like what, though? Tell me.
Well, let me give you one example. I mean, since yesterday, the internet has been rife with a story that Zahi had a fake chamber shown on television during that famous 2002 exploration of the Great Pyramid.
Okay, I remember that.
Have you seen this thing going on the internet?
No, I haven't seen that. But
well, I got it this morning. Okay, let me give you the background of this, because your listeners may get a bit baffled without knowing the background of
okay.
stories. Yes, as we talked many times on your show, since 1993, we've known that there are doors at the end of narrow shafts inside the Great Pyramid, specifically the shafts that emanate from the Queen's Chamber. One of them was discovered, one of these doors was discovered in 1993 mm-hmm. by Rudolf Gantenbrück, the German robotic engineer. I was very involved with this affair. And in 2002, until, in fact, 2002, nothing happened. Everybody was hoping that there would be another exploration, that this famous door, the so-called Gantenbrück door, would be opened and we'd know what's behind it. But nothing happened. In spite of Zahi crying wolf, I don't know how many times. I mean, it's become a sort of... nobody believes it anymore, because he would come and say... we're going to open the door in a few months' time. We're going to open the door before Christmas. And went on for years. However, finally, it was announced that in 2002, in September, if I recall well, the National Geographic was going to explore these shafts of the Queen's Chamber live, on the live program, which happened. In fact, it was the 17th of September, if I recall well. Do you know why I remember this date?
Okay.
Because it's the signature of the American Constitution.
Ah, okay.
There you are. And it happened to be, by the way, Yom Kippur, the Jewish festival at the time.
Okay.
So it caused quite a stir in the Arab press, if I remember well. But anyway, coming back to that, what happened during that live show, and it was quite a show, National Geographic was broadcasting live in 42 countries, I think. They estimated that there was over a billion viewers. I mean, a lot of people were watching this. And, of course, a lot of money coming in from this show. I'm saying this because he's been accused of all sorts of hanky-panky with commission deals and so forth.
Okay.
However, during that program, National Geographic attempted to see what was behind the Gantenbrück door. It's a door that's at the end of the southern shaft of the Queen's Chamber. And live on the show, they drilled a very small hole to put in a fiber optic camera.
With a light inside, right?
With a light inside. And surprise to everybody, there was a second door behind the first door, behind the Gantenbrück door. And this is the position that we are at even now.
Mm-hmm.
Regarding this shaft, the second door has not yet been opened. However, not on this show, but a few days or a few weeks later, it's a bit confusing, we're not quite sure, National Geographic explored the northern shaft of the Queen's Chamber. And at the end of that shaft, they found a similar door, that looked very much like the Gantenbrück door. Now, let me describe this a bit. It's in fact, door is a big word for this. It's more like a trap door. They're about 20 centimeters by 20 centimeters square. And on those doors, there are what appears to be copper handles, two strips of copper that look like handles. Okay, having said this, pictures of this door in the second shaft, or in the so-called northern shaft, were published. So there are, in fact, two shafts, and each shaft has doors at the end of it. What's been circulating on the internet, clearly the person who circulated this misunderstood this completely, because he thought that it was it was a door fabricated by Zahi, a fake door, of one of the shafts. He didn't realize there were two shafts. So this whole story has been going on the internet, that as he compared the images of the doors, he saw that they looked different, and therefore said, aha, this is a fake door made by Zahi. And it was all a con, and he's fooled the whole world. Now, this is nonsense. But it's the kind of rumors that that can cause quite a lot of problems.
Oh, sure.
And let me tell you, I'm not pleased with this at all, because Zahi has done a lot of good things, but he's done a lot of bad things as well. This kind of rumors allows him to say, look, what people say, they say this nonsense, and I can easily prove it's not true.
Right.
And therefore, by doing that, he kind of covers up the other things which are true.
Yeah.
So, you know what I mean?
The things that he really does, he can cover up.
Exactly. And so I'm really very, very angry with people who start these kind of stories without checking their information. And there is another case that has happened, by the way, last week, and you may have picked it up on the internet, where an American fashion clothes company called Zulu Art, if I'm not mistaken, announced that they were launching a new line of men's clothes with the label Zahi Hawass.
Yeah.
Have you heard about this?
Yeah, I did.
And they did a photo shoot at the New York exhibition, Tutankhamun exhibition, in November last year. And they put it on the internet a few days ago. There was a huge, huge reaction to this. And unfortunately, the Egyptian papers got it a bit wrong and assumed that the photo shoot was done in the Cairo Museum. And they went bananas over this.
Uh-huh.
And now, it allowed Zahi to say, well, I can easily prove that it wasn't done at the Cairo Museum. It was done in the New York exhibition. That doesn't absolve him of the real problem with this. Let me explain. I think it's in every country, but there is a very strict rule in Egypt that somebody in an official position, and certainly a minister, is not allowed to use his position to commercialize anything.
Exactly. Exactly. It's bad enough, Robert, that some members of their families do this, you know, and they try to keep that arm's length approach, but that doesn't work. But you're right. This is a direct involvement.
Well, you've got this going on in the States as well. You know?
Sure. Oh, yes, we do.
And it's a deplorable practice. In some countries, they try and cover it by, like you say, by either having distant members of the family acting as the representatives, or, in fact, having companies behind companies behind companies. This is a well-known practice, unfortunately. But in this case, it was quite blatant. I mean, there it was, Zahi Hawass label on a range of clothes, but advertised against Egyptian antiquities. And that's terrible.
Yeah.
I mean, he's actually using not just his position as minister, but his position as minister of antiquities to commercialize, or having others commercialize, clothes.
And now, is it true also, Robert, that anybody who wants to do any excavations or or to go through any kind of a mission or study of some of the artifacts, you got to go through him. You have to go through Zahi.
Absolutely. I mean, Zahi Hawass was a one-man show of the Spanish Inquisition. I mean, you couldn't get through him. Luckily, in my kind of work, I didn't need to go through him that much because most of it doesn't require me to be on location. I mean, I do a lot of research in astronomy and so forth. But a lot of other researchers, and I'm thinking of Robert Schock, for example, or John West, were completely barred, and many, many others. But it isn't just being blocked to do research. Those who did, in fact, get to do research and excavations, whenever they found something, there was Zahi barging in and taking control of the new discoveries and making it his own. This has been going on for years and years. He's a man who, you know, how shall I put it? His ego has become so big, and it showed so much, excuse me,
well, and he got away with it under the Mubarak administration.
He got away with it under the Mubarak administration, but I have to say that the American media has been very much responsible for making Zahi what he is.
That's true.
You know, with all due respect, I mean, National Geographic, Fox Television, and various others, it has always been baffling to me. But I suppose I can understand it up to a point. I mean, there was a kind of need to create a real live Indiana Jones, and Zahi fitted that image, or rather, an image was created for Zahi.
That's right.
Probably a better way of looking at it. And I've always said that, you know, it's a dangerous thing to do because he had to live up to this image. And when finally, you know, people are seeing the real Zahi, you know, where he came out on chasing mummies in a completely different way that people had perceived them through the other shows. Suddenly, everybody got a shock.
Yeah.
I mean, here was supposed to be this heroic Indiana Jones saving Egypt and saving the monuments and dashing around and making wonderful explorations. And then suddenly we see a man who is completely aggressive, agitated, totally illogical. So to me, it's something very dangerous that he played. But he actually believed it. That's the funny thing about Zahi.
I'm told, Robert, that student archaeologists would, from Egypt, for example, would try to be in his office or maybe work in his office, and he was just belittling all of them, all of them.
And, well, we've seen it on TV. I mean, There's a scene that is quite extraordinary to be shown on TV in Chasing Mummies, is when a young so-called intern, if I recall her name, Zoe, I think she was called, must have been in her late 20s or early 30s, was recruited for this show. She actually was, I think she had studied anthropology somewhere in Canada, I'm not quite sure, but she had changed careers. She was an actress and model, and they picked her up for this part. She fitted the sort of docile, pretty intern who was being taught by Zahi, among others, what real archaeology was. But she was bullied to such an extent that it was unbelievable. And there is a scene inside the Great Pyramid in the relief chambers, where the poor girl was desperate to go to the toilet, and she actually peed in the chamber. Mm. Hello, are you still there?
Yeah, we're going to take this break, though, Robert. We're at the top of the hour, and also Ahmed Osman is going to join us as well for a little bit. We'll be back.